Hello, and welcome to Physics Frontiers, episode number 58, Phantom Matter. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/58. Show notes include the papers we read for this program, so that you can read along, and related episodes of Physics Frontiers, so you can check those out as well. And now, Jim and Randy.
Hey, Randy, what's going on?
Jim, it's good to hear from you. We got a fun topic today.
We have a topic. What is today's topic?
Well, are we going to call this the Higgs Portal?
The Higgs Portal is good. Did you have another name you liked?
Well, I liked Phantom Matter, which came up in the first paper that we looked at with Frank Wilczek's paper.
Oh, I sent you Frank Wilczek's paper as well?
The Higgs Field Portal in the Hidden Sectors, yeah. That's a pretty snappy name, Phantom Matter. You know, it sounds like ectoplasm.
Yes, it was. I'm glad I sent it to you, because I didn't read that till this morning. Which ones did I send you? Did you get Can WIMP Dark Matter Overcome the Nightmare Scenario?
You betcha.
Was the other one Higgs Portal, Fermionic Dark Matter, and the Standard Model like Higgs at 125 GeV?
Yep.
And then I have the Atlas report for the latest one that I know of from 2020.
Yeah, you sent me that one. Unfortunately, I didn't have time to read that one, so I just skipped ahead and read the latest update from CERN. Probing Dark Matter with the Higgs Boson. Quick synopsis on there. Yeah, you sent me that.
That was a webpage.
Yeah, that was like a status report basically online.
Oh, well, good, good. I mean, to be honest, for the last one, the first section and the last section are things we might want to talk about. The rest of it is basically just explaining why everything they were doing is okay. I mean, it has good stuff. It says, you know, what is the experiment really? How are we doing all the simulations and all that other stuff? But it's, you know, really nuts and bolts sort of stuff, which is a little bit lower level than we usually like to talk about.
Yeah, the Frank Wilczek paper, though, is a nice, really high level. It was a brief paper, but it was deeply rooted in the theoretical arguments. I just really love this stuff. You know, I'm not sure what comes up in a lot of these papers is the topic of dark matter and the WIMPs, the weakly interacting massive particles. I'm not sure if WIMPs are totally synonymous with phantom matter. Is that correct?
Well, I don't think they're totally synonymous. I think phantom matter is, or stuff in the Higgs portal. I think it's sort of a subcategory.
One of the candidates of WIMPs. Okay.
Yeah, so you could probably have other ideas for WIMPs that weren't the same thing, but I'm not completely sure because Wilczek made up the name and apparently it didn't stick.
That's a shame. It's so much better than WIMPs.
Yeah.
People would much rather learn about phantom matter. Come on.
Well, yeah, but you have phantom matter that's explaining dark matter, and then everybody's going to be confused.
Well, yeah, but they're going to enjoy being confused because it sounds so cool. It sounds like Ghostbusters. It comes out of those really deep considerations on the gauge symmetries of the Standard Model and the Higgs boson, right? That paper was 2008, so that was before we had even detected the Higgs boson. But its properties were so well known at that point that you could see theoretically how it might fit in and possibly explain dark matter.
For that paper, Wilczek looks at basically two different kinds of, maybe three, but basically two different kinds of ways that the Higgs could interact with a different kind of WIMP, right? So he has two different WIMPs. He has one that's basically just a singlet. You add in one new particle to the Standard Model, and that new particle is then the dark matter. The Higgs interacts directly with that. And then the other one is you end up with a second full set of matter, like the Standard Model, and the Higgs is the way those two couple. In fact, it's the interaction between the Higgs of those two Standard Models that couple the matter between them.
Yeah, that clarified something for me that I'd never really understood before, so that's why I really enjoyed this topic, is when I see the term WIMPs in the literature, I was left with the impression that it either meant particles that either only interacted through the weak interaction, you know, the electroweak interaction, or that it was matter that only interacted, you know, very subtly. I was kind of getting mixed up with something along the lines of the neutrino, but this clarified that, you know, we're talking about a particle which sort of has its own physics that's unobservable to us except through the Higgs coupling mechanism. And you can kind of understand why that would be so difficult to observe, because we only detected the Higgs boson a few years ago and we haven't mastered the art of understanding all of its interactions, right? We haven't really started interacting other fundamental particles with it in a controlled way. You know, we can only kind of indirectly detect these kind of interactions either through astronomical means, which dark matter may be an indication of, or by like missing quantities, missing momenta and so forth in particle collider experiments, or in these wide range of experiments that are ongoing right now to see if these dark matter particles annihilate each other and leave some kind of signature that we can detect, right? One of the things that I'd like to understand a little more clearly before we proceed is they're talking about this singlet field interaction. Familiar with the singlets in the sense of spin coupling, like where you have like Cooper pairs, where you have electrons, you know, bound to each other to create, you know, a non-net spin pair. Is he talking about field which is somehow spin coupled to itself at all places? What is exactly the singlet field that they're talking about?
Okay, so my feeling from reading these things is that it's a field that satisfies the U1 symmetry, and it doesn't have three different versions running around. It just has the one version. That's been sort of my feeling.
Okay.
And so there is the chance, for example, that there'd be a real standard model singlet, right? The standard model accepts a singlet, but, you know, that would have to, and satisfies that U1 symmetry. But problem is there aren't any generating fields for that singlet in the standard model. So that's why you have to add another singlet in there by hand, basically, to get that. You know, another full standard model, what the hell.
And so is that other standard model, is that like the supersymmetry model that we're talking about? Super particles?
I don't think it has to be. I think it just has to be another set of particles with, you know, the same sort of symmetries, although they don't have to be the same, right? They don't have to be, you know, you have up and down quarks with these properties and strange and charm quarks with these properties. They can have a different set of properties as long as they're orthogonal to the standard model particles. So that they don't interact. And if you had that second set, then there does end up in the Lagrangian being one term, basically, that ends up mixing the Higgs particles. And that mixing is what would let you observe things.
Okay. So the second paper talked a bit about the nightmare scenario, which we, frankly, seem to be in.
Yeah, it wasn't until I read this yesterday or the day before, reread it. The second time, I went through very carefully to figure out exactly what that nightmare scenario was. I think you're right. It's where we are today.
Right. And the nightmare scenario they're talking about is that the LHC is capable of detecting the Higgs boson, which has happened, but it doesn't reach enough energy level, a high enough energy level to detect any new physics.
Well, basically. So the idea was they were hoping that if you detected the Higgs, you detect, you know, these singlets or something similar to them at the same time or in the same range. So I think, what were they looking at? They were saying that they thought it was almost certain that the mass scale for these other guys would be below 1 TeV. And it turns out that the LHC is operating at about 13 TeV. And so far, they don't have a lot of good data. We'll talk about the data probably a little bit later.
Well, and they were even looking at the other energy, at a higher energy scale for theoretical reasons, right? They said, well, if it's not under 1 TeV, it would favor the 10 TeV regime. And here they are at 13, and they still haven't seen anything.
They were saying, I've got it written down here, that this is actually the tree level limit, right? This is the limit for the sort of lowest level interactions, at least the way they formulated things, is 10 TeV. That was, now we've been operating, or they've been operating that for several years. We'll talk about what they've got from the ATLAS experiment a little bit later on. That data is from 2015 to 2018. And you're not seeing that physics, really. The scary thing is that you go to the LHC, you spend billions of dollars to smash protons into other protons, and all you get is the Higgs particle. But at least they got the Higgs particle. They figured out that it was, you know, 126 or 125 GeV in mass. They did get that. And so they did get that. And they're not just looking at one kind of particle here. They're looking at, you know, three different particles types, right? The scalar, the fermionic matter, and the vector. Really, I would have thought it would all be fermionic, although that seems to be the hard one, right? The scalar and the vector says to me they're looking at different forces, right? Usually that's what we have, is that the integer spin stuff like the Higgs, the electromagnetic field, the strong force, and the graviton, if it exists, those are all integers. And then quarks have integer spins, electrons have half integer spins, and so on. So that's usually what I think of as matter, and the other ones as fields. Now, that maybe there is just a force with nothing to act on sitting around, and that's what the dark matter is, right? That's a really weird idea, but, you know, maybe that's what it is.
That can be made to fit inside the standard model because the Higgs... if Wilczek was talking about the how the mass dimension of the standard model is all the particles and fields in there have a mass dimension of 4, and yet the Higgs field has a mass dimension of 2, and I think he was saying that that's what allows this other possibility, this other type of field to exist, right? This invisible phantom matter.
Well, that's the reason why it should be able to couple to that field.
Okay.
So because it has that mass dimension of 2, it should be able to couple to a singlet if it exists. Technically, these things have to be interacting some way with a graviton, right? If a graviton exists. Because, you know, otherwise we wouldn't have to postulate dark matter. It does something with gravity. You know, we see effects that are best described by some particle that we cannot see interacting with gravity. And it's not just... we can't see it because there's no light shining off of it or anything like that. It's because it just doesn't interact with anything except the gravity.
Right. And so that's why the Higgs became, you know, the portal is because, you know, the Higgs is the mediator for mass, right? And so we know that we're detecting dark matter as presence of mass. So whatever is making up dark matter must have a mass term that could interact with the Higgs boson. I don't want to jump too far ahead because... you know, they spent years refining these models and making very precise predictions for where they should find these kind of detections and pair creations and all this kind of stuff. It's just really troubling that it's such a great and such a sensible approach to the dark matter problem, and yet they're still seeing no deficits or any anomalies that can help us understand what that particle might be.
Well, yeah, and it's very disconcerting, especially with a lot of these things. You know, these Japanese guys, Kanemura, Matsumoto, Nabeshima, and Okada. Okada? I didn't just pick this paper because Okada's at the University of Alabama. He went there after I left there, so I never even met him.
Oh, that was your way where you graduated.
Yeah, I promise. I promise that's not the reason why I chose it. I chose it because I just like the nightmare scenario in the title.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's a really good paper. I mean, I'm just really worried. You look at these some of the things that they've calculated, and you would think that you should see something now. I mean, they were just using a number in there. They were just kind of guessing at what it would be. But now you should see something at about, 63 gigaelectron volts. And if you look at all the calculations they've done, if one of these things is true, you probably should be seeing something like that. They don't see it. If dark matter is lighter than half the Higgs boson mass, it should be decaying into dark matter sometimes. And apparently at the time, in 2010, it looked like there was a trace in some of the, I forget the name of the experiment, in one of the experiments.
The Xenon 100 experiment? Or the CDMS-2?
I think the CDMS-2, is that what you called it?
I think so.
Yeah, I think the CDMS-2 looked like they had a trace at about that point that was, you know, maybe at 2 sigma or something like that. It wasn't the really strong signal that people like, but there was a signal there. But apparently we don't really see that signature anymore. That's a little bit sad. You know, with a really good theory like this, it would be nice to actually see something coming out of it. I mean, that doesn't kill it, right? Because if dark matter has a mass that's larger than, you know, half the Higgs mass, you're not going to see it decaying like that. But it's still a little bit sad that you don't see it. It would be nice to be able to see it in these experiments.
Yeah, with the current energy levels of the Large Hadron Collider, and you're saying that they've looked at data up until 2018, and it looks like they've eliminated most of the theoretically favorable parameter space for that particle, right?
This is worse because, I mean, from the previous things we've done with dark matter, or I've read, not necessarily that we've done, I mean, it looks like the WIMP is the only option. This seems to be the sort of class of the best theories I've seen for describing what the WIMP would look like.
Because it's rooted really on the foundations of the standard model and the gauge symmetries of that model, right?
Yeah. If you look at Wilczek's notes at the end of his article, there are a bunch of things where he's saying, well, you know, this thing is a little bit like this kind of supersymmetry. This is a little bit like this guy's theory over here and stuff like that. But, you know, these classes of arguments are really the sorts of arguments that get you the standard model, get you those fields. They integrate really well with the standard model. And you'd think that any beyond the standard model sort of physics would integrate really well with the standard model because the standard model works so well. And you don't have to do something like, you know, with a lot of superstring theories, postulate, well, it's maybe not a billion, but a whole new set of particles that we should be seeing that just don't show up, like the Beano. The Beano should be seen in the same range that we're talking about.
The Beano? What is that?
It's the supersymmetric version of the B meson.
Oh, I see. Okay.
That was one of the candidates for seeing something in this window, and it didn't show up.
As I understand it, pretty much every supersymmetric model had at least one particle that should have been detectable by now, right?
Probably, but at this point, they have categories of supersymmetric models, right?
Oh, okay.
So it's not like it used to be where there were like three or separate models, supersymmetric models for particle physics. They figured out how to parameterize those, and they found that there's like this continuum mode in the center. I think this is what we were talking about with the string theory landscape. Maybe it's just string theories, but anyways, I mean, still with string theories, bad enough. So you have this continuous region of string theories in the center, and then you have an infinite number of, but it's just a countably infinite number of string theories pockmarked on the side. Basically, we'd be in one of those countably infinite number that are running around on the side, they think, or at least Siskind thought. We've got this nightmare scenario, and I don't know how we're going to get out of it. Did you see a way to get out of it?
Well, I think the author's conclusion was that it seems, you know, that we may be in what's like an unnatural part of the universe, that of the, you know, entire unobservable cosmos, that we would have to be just in a region which has this kind of anomalous particle and field zoo that doesn't come out naturally. And so their look at the hierarchy problem was, well, yeah, we're just kind of in this aberration part of the universe where, you know, matter and fields as we understand them can exist. So, you know, we're going to have to look at these more extreme regions. That's sort of the takeaway that I had from that.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like that if we're going to find anything, we're going to have to find it from looking at even higher energy experiments.
Right.
If you can get somebody to finance them.
Right. If you can build even larger colliders. But I think the takeaway that I was getting was that, you know, it gets hard to theoretically explain particles in those really high energy regions. Like, it seems like as you get into higher and higher energy levels that are, you know, less accessible to like the Large Hadron Collider, it gets really hard to kind of theoretically find the justifications and the mechanics of how it all works.
I think one of the things that Wilczek said was, and this may be just something everybody knows but me, was that if this hidden sect, if the dark matter was really, really massive, even with gravity, the thermal bath, the thermal cloud of dark matter should be actually increasing masses of the things in the standard model. And I don't understand how that works.
That's right. He would say that it would lift up the masses, I guess, of all the particles that we can observe in the standard model. But since they're so small, that's hard to justify.
That's right. And that's part of the reason why he wanted to go with the phantom matter and create the Higgs portal. So, yeah, I mean, it gets harder and harder to justify that. Plus, I mean, if you're trying to convince somebody to build you this bigger accelerator, it would be nice to have something sort of concrete to be looking for, right?
Right. Like, we could expect to find this crazy particle that explains dark matter at, you know, 100 tera electron volts. So just give us the $1 trillion it takes to build this detector and we'll get it. That's how it worked with the Large Hadron Collider, right? It's like, we think we can detect the Higgs boson at the very least.
Yeah, and now it doesn't look like they have that. They have, well, we know there's got to be something else out there because we know there's dark matter. We know there's dark energy. That means that there's got to be something more somewhere for something.
That's right.
But you don't really have a good idea about what it is or why, you know, your collider would let you see into it, which is, you know, the opposite of this particular case. If you looked at the search for the invisible Higgs boson from the ATLAS collaboration, the 139 inverse femtobarns, which is the scattering cross-section, that gives a really good, really interesting idea about how they would actually detect something like this. They have a really good idea about how they detect it. And basically what happens is if you have a proton-proton collision, you'll end up with the jets at a really, really large angle. They call it pseudorapidity, but that's just a Lorentzian variant kind of idea about an angle. You know, if you didn't have a really large angle between them, and if you looked at this, you have traces that would say that you were missing a lot of momentum. That's basically what they're doing, is they're looking at these collisions, which if they had these really, really large angles with missing transverse momentum, then what would be happening is that creating this Higgs particle.
That would be decaying into these other particles, right?
Yeah, and it would decay into other particles that you couldn't see. That transverse momentum would go into the dark matter particles rather than into, like, these quarks that you would have seen. Or you wouldn't see the quarks, but, you know, the protons collide. The quarks are basically colliding, which means that you'd see whatever particles coming out the other side, which would be, like, protons or neutrons or something.
And that's what this Higgs portal is, right? The Higgs portal, it would be that momentum would be disappearing through the Higgs portal and into this hidden sector.
Well, yeah, the Higgs portal is... The Higgs is interacting with regular matter, and it's also interacting with the dark matter. And because the Higgs is interacting with the dark matter, that's the portal into that sort of dark matter universe, into that phantom sector. That's where the phantom sector looks like. And actually, it didn't look great, but it didn't look too bad up until basically this year. Both ATLAS and CMS had some data where, you know, didn't look super great, but, you know, you had about a 0.1% greater observed transverse momentum than what you expected. No, this is a branching fraction. You were getting less stuff than you expected because the branching fraction is how much stuff is invisible. You were getting less stuff than you expected, but then they sort of improved things with this run that ended in 2018. So they went from 36 inverse femtobarns to 139 inverse femtobarns. And the trace went away. I mean, it literally went away, right? It went from, you know, observing 0.26% when you previously thought it would be 0.17% to being observing 0.13% where you thought it was 0.13%. And that eliminates, they didn't say it eliminates, but it looks like it would eliminate any of these mediators or any dark matter with masses in the 50 giga electron volt to 1 tera electron volt range.
Wow.
Yeah, they just interpreted it as a search, and they didn't see anything. There are two basic ways that dark matter could be there. One of them is the direct production that I was talking about before, is the Higgs breaks off in those two singlets. And after it breaks off into those two singlets, they become, you know, two different particles of dark matter. This one doesn't.
But on the other hand, this is kind of how the search for the Higgs boson went for a long time, too, is they just started eliminating parameter spaces, right? Like, okay, it's not in this region, it's not in this energy level, and then eventually they stumbled across it, right?
Yeah. I mean, there was that. I mean, I remember in, like, 2000, somewhere around there, going to some place, and the guy putting overlays on overlay, you know, this experiment, that experiment for the Higgs, and nothing was going on. But again, for both of these papers about the Higgs portal from before, where they did all the calculations, it looked like there would be a strong signature due to a resonance somewhere. Basically, there should be a resonance somewhere around 1 tera electron volt for this, if it exists, probably, for a resonant Higgs portal. But there's also the indirect thing. It's possible that the dark matter comes with a dark field to go with it. If the dark matter interacts with the other dark matter, then there's probably two species, at least. Fermionic dark matter and bosonic dark matter, probably. They did some calculations with that, and it doesn't really look like we see anything that should be there. But it's possible. It's possible for the Higgs to be interacting with either one.
Is it possible for there to be, like, a phantom sector that has massive particles that doesn't couple to the Higgs?
I'm not sure. It didn't sound like it from anything that anybody was talking about here, but they were looking for that in particular. But I guess if you had a Phantom Sector that didn't have a singlet, maybe so, but the Higgs couples to other matter as well.
Yeah, if it's got mass, it should couple. Because of the dimensional operators, it would have to interact with the Higgs boson, right? Because I was wondering, just, you know, maybe there's a different, you know, mass dimension somehow for this Phantom Sector, so that it wouldn't interact with our Higgs, but maybe it would have its own Higgs.
Well, that's possible. If you think about these things, a lot of them sound like some of vector tensor or vector scalar theories of gravity. You know, if you start thinking about the graviton as the tensor part of the vector tensor theory of gravity, and then you end up with one of these other fields, that gives you a modified gravity. And so it's possible that, you know, you just have a completely different thing that somehow couples a little bit to gravity, and you end up with a different field that only couples to gravity.
Oh, Jesus, that would be trouble.
But yeah, I mean, a lot of these things, if you start thinking about them and trying to make the analogies, they feel like a lot of those alternate gravity theories that we talked about from Will and stuff like that.
Yeah, Clifford Will, yeah. But it seems like so many of those were, you know, being sort of systematically eliminated by the data, you know.
From the data that we have, it looks more or less like general relativity is the only game in town, right?
Yeah.
And we have some really interesting modifications, like Verlinda's entropic gravity. It's really interesting and it gives some good results, but most of them just don't seem to hold up very well at all.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by that direction. Apparently he thinks that he can explain both dark matter and dark energy using this like information theory approach to gravity. Is that right? I'm not sure if that's been borne out by other researchers, but
I don't think anybody else has really done anything with it. As far as I did see a YouTube lecture of his. I haven't really seen a lot of other people doing it. So obviously other people are interested in it, because once again, we have the situation with gravity. Well, actually, we're talking about the situation with gravity because dark matter is one of the situations, right?
Yeah.
And so people are interested in different ways to approach that. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. Unfortunately, it looks very similar here, right? The standard model seems to have the same issue that general relativity does, which is we know it doesn't work quite right. We know that there's something that's not being said, but anything we can do to test it, it looks like it's right. Anything where we have a specific, hard, real theory why the standard model is wrong, is wrong. The standard model survives whatever that is whenever we try to test that. It's the same thing with general relativity. We say, okay, there's some problem with gravity, and we try to test it, and general relativity wins. And that is true for, you know, both areas of physics, even though basically what we're saying in both cases is that we have these astronomical observations that tell us they're wrong. At some level, there's something that we're doing wrong, and I think it's more critical for the standard model than for general relativity, right? For general relativity, if there's something that we can't see by other means, that's no big deal for general relativity.
Right. It's got the cosmological constant term in there already. You know, you can make sense of it through pressure. And when you look at like a uniform energy content of space-time, you can easily explain the dark energy effect.
Yeah. I mean, basically, you just have to change the stress energy tensor based on the fact that there's something else after you know what that other thing is, right? Until you know what that other thing is, you don't really know what to do with it. Right now, it's not as bad for general relativity because, general relativity keeps looking more and more like it's true. It's sort of bad for the theoretical astronomy stuff because you don't know what the dark energy and the dark matter are, but, you know, that's their problem. But it is bad for the standard model because the standard model does not say there's this other thing out there that we can't see.
There's no gap anywhere in the standard model where this could fit.
We're stuck with trying extensions and hoping those extensions will improve what we see.
Well, one of the regimes that was mentioned in one of these papers, I can't remember which one, they were talking about looking at the early universe and looking for, I guess they're saying that the Phantom Sector would have cooled off much earlier than the matter that we can see. And so that's why it wouldn't have played a part in like the early inflationary, like nucleosynthesis processes and stuff like that. But maybe we could see some signs of it if we could refine our gravitational wave detectors well enough to see beyond the surface of last scattering and get an idea of what was happening gravitationally in the very, very early instance of the Big Bang. Like maybe we could detect some missing matter in there or something.
Yeah, I mean, we'd have to detect them, but I'm sure they've got some idea. Somebody's looked at that somewhere and said, this is what we should see. it's highly likely that if there's some deviation from that, you know, it'll be some extra part of matter that we don't see. I mean, I'm not completely sure what's going on with the standard model singlet, which, again, we just said could exist. The standard model accepts that it could exist. It just doesn't have anything to generate it. It's okay in the standard model to have a singlet field, but it doesn't make itself, right? Maybe there's some way somebody could think about at really high energies to make something like that. But they probably already have, you know, they've already figured out how that would work and said, well, it doesn't work. That's usually the case with easy ideas like that, right? Anyways, sorry.
No, it's intriguing to me, you know, how the dark matter problem especially seems to be like the perfect arrow to expose the key problem that we have of not being able to really integrate general relativity with the standard model. It seems to be slipping right through the crack of unification. It's like it's just showing us the vital, essential clarion call for a unified field theory. Because until we build that bridge between the standard model and general relativity, there seems to be this nagging problem of dark matter that we just don't seem to know how to approach the problem at all. That's why I'm intrigued by the Verlin's approach with the tropic gravity, because it's an entirely new way of looking at it, you know, in terms of information density and everything. So maybe we're just thinking about the entire problem.
That's almost certainly the case. If we were thinking about the problem right, then one of these giant brains would have come up with the answer already, right?
Yeah. So yeah, Wilczek would have had it.
Well, yeah. Well, in fact, I was watching something by Feynman just a little while ago, and he was saying, you know, if it was any of the things, if the way to approach this was any of the ways we knew how to approach anything, we would have already approached it that way. I mean, it took a genius to look at the geometry of space-time, but once he does it, then all sorts of other people decide, okay, well, we can look at this in all sorts of different ways. It took a genius to figure out something like the uncertainty principle. But once that's happened, you know, there are lots of intelligent people that can use that same trick. So it's going to have to be some, you know, new trick to figure out what's going on here. So somebody's going to have to figure stuff out. And I think that's what we see here, right? If we look here, what Wilczek's done is he's used basically the same ideas that particle physicists, that string theorists have used previously to make good models, right? And he's made a really, really good model based on the way that people make models that way, that kind of reasoning. It doesn't seem to be working. And so most likely it's not he got, you know, the model wrong thinking this way. It's more likely that there's some other way he should be thinking.
Some more fundamental model that would have a new way of asking the question.
Exactly how that is going to work, I do not know. But probably you're waiting for somebody to think of a brand new way to do things. If you're waiting for somebody to figure out a brand new way to do things, the wait could be short, the wait could be long, but you don't know.
Yeah, it was centuries between Newton and Einstein, right? So it's kind of daunting to think that it could take a breakthrough of that magnitude, a mind to probe into an entirely new way of looking at space, time, energy, and matter in order to frame the question properly.
I mean, it's not that bad. We've got the data. That's giving us some ways to point. We've got lots of people that are working on it. Yeah. So the only worry is the reward structure going to help or hurt somebody who's trying to improve things?
By reward structure, you mean just the whole, what, academic publication system? And
publications, grants, things like that. Publications, less so. I think publications are reasonably easy. I mean, it might be hard to get into Nature, but there are a lot of less prestigious journals that somebody could get the things published in. And then, you know, if it seems to be working, people will build on it. Maybe not the great guys right away, but eventually somebody would notice. There is a lot of stuff in the literature, so maybe it wouldn't get noticed. But I mean, if you're doing the right things, if you're going to conferences, if you're talking to people, and you have something that looks like it's working, probably it'll be okay. But the grant structure is a little bit more difficult. There's a lot less money to go around. And if you're not right there at the top, there's a lot less money to go around. You know, you could have a maverick that decides they're going to be able to do this. I mean, there are places that they could actually work, possibly get something like that going on, even if the people who are reviewing grants don't like it. But still unlikely, because those guys have career goals and stuff like that, like anyone else. So
there is a kind of deterrent to coming up with breakthrough models, right? Like, because people are like, I don't recognize this. This isn't how we approach these problems.
Yeah, there could be at some level something like that. Although, I mean, I think with physicists, I think most of them really do love what they do, which includes playing around with the new things that some crazy guy figured out. I mean, I don't think that's too much of an issue. I mean, it is something you have to worry about because, you know, in some ways it feels like science is going so fast these days. There's so much going on. But in some other ways, it feels like things have really slowed down, right? I mean, I've been reading the Feynman lectures on gravitation that he gave in like 1962. He gave this graduate class in quantum gravity in the same year that he did the Feynman lectures on physics. And the things he's saying are the things these other guys are saying in these papers that we're reading from 2017.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's been a lot of work done, but it's still the same stuff. On the level, of, you know, when I'm looking at the metamaterials and I'm looking at, you know, a lot of the different ideas people have put out for lots of different things, you know, you see a lot of things going on, but they're still doing that stuff that Feynman was doing in 1962. In fact, even the reformulation of general relativity that people did in the, you know, 1990s or whenever that allowed people to do stuff like loop quantum gravity, it's in that book. It's the same sort of thing that he was doing in that book. So there must be subtle differences, but or maybe they're not so subtle, but there must be differences. But on the other hand, Feynman was doing the same sort of Lagrangian theory of gravity that would later on be used to help formulate loop quantum gravity and other quantum gravities. Okay, I do have to teach a class, yeah, and it's time to get off my soapbox, especially since I don't know what I'm talking about anyway. So thank you very much for talking about this. It was fun. It was really interesting for me, at least, to find out about this Higgs portal, even if it doesn't look like it worked. It was a really, really clever idea. I like the idea a lot. It's just unfortunate that the way I found out about it was looking at this 2020 data paper
from the
Atlas collaboration that basically said it didn't work.
But it was a great idea.
It was a great idea. All right.
Thanks for your time, Jim.
Thank you, Randy. It's been good.
All right. Enjoy your class. Bye-bye.
I will. You have just listened to Physics Frontiers episode number 58, Phantom Matter. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/58. Show notes include the papers we read for this podcast, as well as related episodes from our back catalog. Also, a couple of months ago, I displayed my ignorance with Anthony Janot and Eve Ellen Bojan on Anthony's podcast, Highbrow Dribble. So if you'd like to listen to that, you can at highbrowdribble.com. Spelt highbrow and dribble with nothing in between. I also hope I got their names right, although I'm not too worried about it because Anthony included all of the silent consonants in my name. Bye now.